Because I want to stress a very important point here as we look at Lot in the city of Sodom. Turn to Galatians chapter 6. This is a very sobering point that you want to try to take in. Because remember, God wants to use the story of Lot to change your life. You know, that's really the purpose. So that you don't make the same mistakes he made with your life. Notice verse 7 of Galatians 6. And by the way, this is not written to Christians. This is not written to unsaved. This is written to Christians. You know, we so often apply these verses to the unsaved. These are written to Christians. Paul was writing to the Christians in Galatia. And he says, verse 7, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that will he also reap." Well, you say, not me. I mean, I'm trusting the Lord and I'm going to heaven. I'm not going to reap any consequences. Yes, you will. You're not immune from this as a Christian. You can reap consequences. Look at verse 8. "For he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption." The Christian has a flesh. "But he who sows to the Spirit," the Christians indwell with the Spirit, "he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap life everlasting." Now most of you here tonight, you're young. You're laying the groundwork for what's to come. Little acts, little things you do that seem so insignificant are shaping your whole life right now. Not later, now. I have this little note at the bottom of this portion. Sow an act, reap a tendency. Sow a tendency, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. Sow a character, reap a destiny. And there it is. It's these little acts. Lot became what he was in Sodom before he ever went into Sodom. Please note this. Sodom didn't make Lot what he was. Lot was what he was before he went to Sodom. That's why he felt at home in Sodom. You see, circumstances do not make us what we are. It's rather the way we react to the circumstances that make us what we are. Two boys can come from the same family. Their father is an alcoholic. One becomes an alcoholic. The other never touches alcohol. Why? They both grew up under the same circumstances. In other words, we cannot use our circumstances. You know, like, well, I come from a broken family, or my mother was mean to me, or I lived in a bad neighborhood, or, you know, we cannot blame our circumstances and what we are. People have lived in far worse circumstances than any of us have tonight, and yet they live for God. Now that's one of the points, you know, we want to establish this before we begin the study with Lot in Sodom. Now let's go back to Genesis and let's look at Lot in Sodom. Chapter 14. He's now living in the city of Sodom. Interestingly enough, God never tells us exactly how this came about. Kind of interesting. never tells us really how he actually got into that city. You know, it doesn't tell us the story of how one day he got up and he finally decided, well, I've looked at that city long enough, living in this tent, I'm just going to go in now. It doesn't tell us whether he made friends before he went in there, or when he got in there, how he made friends, or how he happened to get a house there, and how he happened to get a wife there, and how he happened to, you know, it doesn't tell us any of those details. We just go from the 13th chapter to the 14th, and he's there. He's in the city. I mean, it just happened. And that's the way it is, you know. We flirt, we play around with the world. We live in its fringes. And that's what Lot was doing. And you're soon in it. You're sucked into it, and you're really not exactly sure how it happened. But you're there. You're in it. And you've got consequences to reap. Now, the first thing we want you to notice in his life in Sodom is that the walls of Sodom did not protect him. Let's look at verses 11 and 12 of the 14th chapter. These kings that lived in the area came down and attacked the city. And it says in verse 11, they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. That's an interesting event of history, isn't it? You know, just kind of reads like a history book. Okay, so these great kings came and they attacked these two cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, and they took out all the goods of the cities, all their provisions, and went their way. But you know, God's not interested in history. Really. History doesn't really interest God. God maneuvers history. He controls it. He's interested in individuals. And he's interested in this person called Lot. Now, there probably wasn't another person in that whole area that knew or cared anything about Lot. And as a matter of fact, when the chronologies were written, when the stories and the history was written about the events here in the Middle East at this time, Lot was an absolutely insignificant individual. He was not a general of an army. He was not the mayor of the city. He was not an important character. But yet God, notice verse 12, singles him out. Of that whole city, he singles this one man out. And he says, they also took Lot. That's how the Spirit of God puts it. They also took Lot. They took these two big cities, all their goods, these impregnable cities. Nobody was supposed to be, they had walls, massive walls around. Nobody was supposed to be able to ever conquer these cities, but they took them. And then the Spirit of God says, they also took Lot. Who's he? Abram's brother's son. That's who he is. You see, in God's reckoning, he's somebody. Because he belonged to Abram. And Abram was God's man. And that's the way God reckons things. He isn't interested in generals. He isn't interested in presidents and mayors and entertainers and politicians and athletes. He's interested in people in their relationship to him. Abraham had a right relationship with God, and Lot had a relationship with Abram. So he said, they took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelled in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. Now, the question here is, how come these kings took Lot's goods, but they never took Abram's? You ever think of that? I mean, there Abram was living in a little tent made of skin, animal skins. I mean, a tent is the most vulnerable thing to an army that you can imagine. An army can just flatten a tent in no time at all. And here's Lot behind enormous city walls, right? As thick can be. He was in a fortified city. Now, if you were to say to me, who's more likely to lose their goods by thievery or attacking armies or things, you know, Abram in that little old tent or Lot behind that great big city? I'd say to you, oh, Abram, that guy's vulnerable. But he didn't lose his goods. Lot lost his goods. Tells us something, doesn't it? You know what it tells us? The security of this world isn't worth that much. The earlier we learn it, the better off we're going to be as Christians. We get feeling sometimes so secure. But then sometimes little things like 30-inch snows and overflowing rivers, we get a little shaky at that point, right? We're not quite as secure as we thought we were. And then somebody breaks into our house and steals all the valuable things out of it, and then we feel even a little less secure than we were. Or somebody's house burns down across the street from us. And, you know, it's just amazing how insecure this world really is and how secure we sometimes can become in an insecure world. You know that? We become so secure, so snug in a world that's not secure at all, in no way whatsoever. But we do. You know, if I were to suggest to you that next year at this time, this country could go completely bankrupt. You could lose your job, and lose your house, and lose your possessions. That's ridiculous. That's stupid. What kind of dumb talk is that? Well, that's the way they reacted back in October 1929. I sat and I talked to men who reacted that way. I talked to a man, and I heard one of the saddest stories I've heard in my life. The story went something like this. God had called him to a special work, and he was sure God had. But he had just built a home, and he loved that house. I can still picture this man telling me the story. He's going to be with the Lord now. He loved that house. And he said, no, you know, he rationalized. See how we rationalize these things. And I, well, you know, I got children. I have three boys. And I, you know, they need a house. I can't just give up a house just because the Lord wants me to go to such and such a place, you know, and do such and such a thing. I've got to hold on to this house after all. We don't, you know, And so he rationalized this thing around, and he didn't answer the Lord's call because he wanted to stay in his house. But he didn't have that house paid for. He didn't have it nearly paid for. And when the crash came in 1929, and this actually happened, this man told me the story. He woke up one morning to find out that he lost his job, and he couldn't make the next mortgage payment. And the bank took that house without any mercy at all, sold it out right from under him, and put him out on the street. He lost the house. Just almost like overnight. The security of this world means nothing. Now let's notice the second point. Here he is, he's captured. All his possessions, everything he has. And one who had escaped, verse 13 of chapter 14, one who had escaped came and told Abraham, the Hebrew, for he dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of Aner, and they were allies with Abram. Somebody saw this whole thing happen. So they ran out and they told Abram. And when Abram heard that his brother, interesting term, isn't it? Not his nephew, his brother. Because when he was in trouble, he saw him as a brother. He didn't see him as a nephew. When he heard that his brother was taken captive, he said to the man who told him, you know, that guy deserves everything that's coming to him, and I'm just going to sit back and have a good laugh. Couldn't blame him for doing that at all, could you? But that's not what he did. He armed his 318 trained servants, and he went and delivered him. At the risk of his own life, I might say. The risk of the life of his servants, at the risk of everything Abram had. Why did Abram deliver him? I don't know. You would wonder, wouldn't you, other than God wanted him delivered. Why was Lot unable to help in his deliverance? Why didn't Lot do anything? I mean, why didn't he deliver himself? How is it that Abraham had the means to deliver Lot, and Lot didn't have the means to deliver himself? How is that? Well, you see, the man who lives for God, the man who puts God first in his life, he can't be made captive of this world. This world can't captivate him. It can't control him. But the man who goes in for this world and what it has to offer, he gets so under its control that he has no way of delivering himself from it. None whatsoever. This world becomes absolutely captivating. It holds one in bondage. It gets such a grip on a person that unless that person is delivered by God, there's no way to ever deliver. And of course, we notice things here as we go through this story. Again, you know, just revealing to us all the time something about Lot. Because it's interesting that God sent Abram to deliver Lot. There can be no question about that, can there? But this was God's doing. It doesn't say so, does it? It's interesting in this story. It doesn't really say that God, you know, said to Abraham, now, you get yourself some trained servants and go and deliver that man. It doesn't really say that. But we sense it, don't we? We can see that it's God that put this into the heart of Abram. That unless this man had been spiritually motivated, there's no way he would have bothered with Lot. But yet, to reveal something about Lot, isn't it interesting in the story, it really doesn't tell us that Lot cried out for deliverance. I was just reading this morning in my devotions the story in Ezra where the people had gone back to build the temple, and as they're building that temple, they bring the news to Ezra that the people had sinned terribly. They had married the pagan wives and had given themselves over to pagan idolatry. And you know, Ezra gets down on his knees and he weeps before God. And he cries out to God to deliver himself and his people. We don't notice that with Lot, do we? There's nothing here in the account that Lot broke down and wept and cried out for God to deliver him from his terrible circumstances. But God did it anyway. Well, as we go on with the story, I think we now reach what is one of the saddest, almost incomprehensible points in Lot's life. This is the part that really is so difficult to understand. He's delivered. Notice it says in verse 16, Abraham brought back all the goods. He also brought back his brother Lot and his goods, as well as the women and the people. And then we go over to chapter 19. We don't read of Lot from that point on. Amazing thing. It's almost, you know, as if he suddenly just disappears from the picture. We go through chapter 15 and through chapter 16 and through chapter 17 and through chapter 18. And then we come to chapter 19, verse 1, and it says, two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. What a tragedy. You know what this man did? I mean, he was miraculously delivered. He could have died. Right? He could have been killed. Probably should have been. Why the kings didn't kill him, I can't tell you. You know, we already said he was nobody of any significance. There was no reason for a king to spare him. But they did. And God allowed Abraham to deliver him. Why did he return to Sodom? Well, why did he do that? How can you explain something like that? How can a man turn around and go right back into what God delivers him from? I don't know how to explain it, but it happens all the time. The fools that we are, we do it over and over and over again. I want to tell you something. Every time God delivers you from a foolish move that entrenches you in the world and pulls you away from Himself, draws you away spiritually, causes you to fall into spiritual declension away from God. Every time God delivers you from that, and you turn around and go back into it, the second time, you're going to be worse than the first time. And if God delivers you a second time, and you turn around and do it again, the third time is going to be worse than the second time. In which each time, you're going to entrench yourself deeper into what you're doing. And we see this. We're gonna see this example in the life of Lot. But it's what he did. He went right back to Sodom. And we'll get some indications later on as to probably what some of the reasons were for doing that. But certainly, it was inexcusable, wasn't it? As all of our strains from God are. They're inexcusable. You know what else we notice here too? You know, as we said as we go along, how Lot keeps revealing something about his person. Do you read anywhere there where Lot said, "Brother Abram, thank you. Thank you for risking your life. Thank you for training those men. I appreciate it. I appreciate that you thought of me." No. He was a non-appreciative man. Selfish men usually are, you know. I mean, here's a man who risks his life, you know, goes to no end of trouble to get him out of trouble, and he doesn't even think. Sometimes we can be that way, you know. Sometimes we hurt the most the people who try the hardest to help us. You realize that? We do it many, many times in our Christian life. We appreciate the least the ones who are the most concerned about us and love us and are seeking to help us. And they're usually the ones we stick the dagger into. And that's just what Lot did to Abram. A sad story, really. If you look for a minute forgot to set that timer. Oh, I can't believe I did that. I don't have the faintest idea what time I began. Can somebody tell me? Please tell me when I began. What was it?
About 20 minutes.
20 minutes? Thank you, sir. Can't believe I did that. Then we have bells that ring. Well, anyhow, if you look at 14, chapter 14 of Genesis, verse 21, what you'll notice a very interesting statement here. The king of Sodom said to Abram, this is a tremendous statement, give me the persons and take the goods. Give me the persons, take the goods. What was he saying? I want Lot. You can have his goods. I want Lot. Give me the persons. Take the goods. And that's just what he got, right? You know, the devil isn't interested in the goods. He's interested in the souls, in the person. That's what he's after. And that's what he's after in the life of the Christian. Well, anyway, let's go on. Go back to that 19th chapter again. And look at verse 1 again. I want you to notice that phrase in verse 1. Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate. He was sitting in the gate. Now, that's not a statement, you know, to just mean he was there, you know, just kind of relaxing, enjoying life, and sitting there in a chair by the gate of the city, watching all the people going by. You know, like you do at the mall, and just, you know, kind of observing. No, that's not what that phrase means. If we were to take time, we won't take time tonight, but if we were to take time to explore this statement, sitting in the gate, and you would follow it through, you would discover that it becomes particularly clear, for example, in the book of Esther, where it's used a number of times there. This was a place of prominence in the city. The man who occupied, who sat at the gate of the city, was a man of prominence. He was an important man. He had some prominent position in the city, whatever it may have been. Now, here's the point we want you to get. The second time back into Sodom, Lot rose to prominence. You see that point? He rose to prominence the second time in. Which meant that the city of Sodom had a greater hold upon him than ever before. Now he was a celebrity there. He was an important man there. He had power there. He had prestige. He had wealth there. And so he was deeper into this mess than he was the first time. And of course, that becomes quite apparent because of what God chooses to do. The first time, He sent kings into the city, didn't he? And the kings simply took the people and the possessions, but left the city untouched. The second time, God wipes out the whole city, doesn't he? He destroys everything. He doesn't just destroy the people and their goods. He destroys the whole city. He just wipes it out. He takes it off the map. See? Well, now Lot is identified with this city. He's not just living there. He's now a part of it. He actually has a responsibility for its workings, its operation. He got so involved. The world has a way of doing this, you know. Christians begin to think, you know, we begin to think like the world does, and we begin to think, well, you know, I could probably, I've got a few things to offer to this old world, you know. Maybe if with my influence, my good Christian character and my personality and my leadership qualities, and so maybe I can change this world, make it a better place to live in. I can improve it. And, you know, we tell ourselves this enough times, we begin to believe it. Well, Lot becoming a judge at the gate of this city didn't change the condition of the city, did it? As a matter of fact, it kept getting worse. As a matter of fact, when Christians begin to get involved in this world's politics, when they don't separate themselves and stand off from the world actually becomes worse. It doesn't become better. You know, we have this idea today that if all Christians would get involved in politics, you know, if we'd really be active, we could change this world. We could be a force to change this world. No, it's quite the opposite. The more this world sucks us in and gets us involved with it, the worse it becomes. Because there isn't that Christian influence to restrain and hold back the evil of this world. Because now the Christian becomes a part of it himself. He becomes involved in it. And by the way, that's the scene we see happening right now in the United States of America. See, Christians are becoming more and more involved in the politics, and things are getting worse and worse and worse. Because we're not standing up. We're not restraining that evil. We're not holding it back by the influence of our godly lives. But rather, we're becoming part and parcel of it. Well, as the story goes on, we discover that his influence, his testimony in Sodom was absolutely ineffective. You notice when it comes to an incident in chapter 19, some men came to his doorstep and these men well, let's pick up verse 4. Now before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter, surrounded the house. This is Lot's house. He had a house there. Who knows, might have been one of the best in Sodom. And they surrounded the house. They called to Lot and said to him, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Where are the men?" "Bring them out to us that we may know them." Carnally, that's really what they're talking about here. We're talking about homosexuality. So Lot went out to them through the doorway, shut the door behind him, and notice what he said. "Please, my brethren." Please, my brethren. Remember, Abram delivered his brother Lot. But it never says that Abram was a brother to Lot. You know, you never hear Lot saying, "My brother Abraham." But he says to the men of Sodom, "My brethren, please don't do so wickedly." And he offers them his two daughters. And they said to him, verse 9, "Stand back." That's an interesting word. Stand back. You know what that really means? Get out of the way. Just get out of the way. He had no testimony among these men at all. And in regard to this incident, we have to ask a number of questions. Why did the two angels, when they first came into Sodom there in verse 2, why did they hesitate to stay with Lot? You notice they hesitated to stay with him? He said in verse 2, Lot said, "Here now, my lords, please turn into your servant's house and spend the night. Wash your feet." He gave them a pleasant invitation. And they they said, "No, we'll spend the night in the open square. We'd rather live out there in the open square than go into your house." Why was he willing to give them his daughters? I mean, what kind of a father would turn his two daughters over to a wicked mob of men to placate them? What kind of a father would do this? You see, what I'm trying to show you, see how low things had sunk in this man's life? And then we read when he finally is told by these angels what's going to happen to the city of Sodom. In verse 14 of chapter 19, Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who had married his daughters, and said, Lot said to these sons-in-law, "Get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city." But notice these words. To his sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking. Now, we can read two things into this. Certainly his sons-in-law, the thought that the city of Sodom could be destroyed was a joke to them. You know, they thought no way could this city be destroyed. But I also think that it was not just the news, but it was the source of the news also that made it a joke to them. You know, I think their thing was, how would you know? How would you know that this city is going to be destroyed by the Lord? What do you know about the Lord? You're not a prophet. The man had really, I don't think, any testimony with the men of the city. He certainly had no testimony to the angels, and he certainly had no testimony within his own family. We're going to see this particularly tomorrow when we look at him in relationship to his wife. The man just plain had no testimony. He had become so much a part of Sodom, had intermingled and mixed himself so much with it, that his life, there was nothing left of it for God. You know, it was just an empty nothing. It was a thrown away life. It was a wasted life. It was a man who had given himself to time and to possessions and to wealth and to what this world can offer and to what the city can offer, that he had nothing to offer for God. Nothing whatsoever. Shouldn't our hearts cry out at this point, "Oh God, save me from a life like this"? Shouldn't it? Shouldn't that be our prayer? "Oh God, don't let me come to the end of my days and look back, review my years, and find that they look like the years of Lot. Certainly there's something positive, a message that's positive in a life like this, right? You know, the point is, Lot lived in vain if you and I don't learn a lesson from the way he lived. So that's the point. This life of Lot can still be salvaged if we're willing to learn a lesson from it. And to save ourselves from throwing away our own lives, which can so quickly and so easily be done. Some of us may already be well into throwing our lives away. We may have already begun. We may already be